9th, 2 in the afternoon. The session is The Living Word, and this is Ruth McCree. Okay, what I would like to do this afternoon is to just go over some of the basic things about preparing lessons. All of you are experienced readers, I can tell, and that you've done some of it, and so a lot of the things that I'm going to say will be old hat to you, but some things may be new, and it might be helpful just to pull it together. I'd like to take just a few minutes at the beginning of our session to talk about those things, to call them back to mind, and then I would like to take a few minutes for you to look at the texts that you've brought to work with here, having these things in mind, and then to just let you take turns reading and give you feedback on what you're doing, and to get feedback from the others too, because my perceptions about what I see will be a little different from what others do, and it's helpful sometimes to get that sort of supportive feedback so that we get a sense of how we're coming and, you know, what's being communicated, because that's what it's all about. Before I begin, I would like to know from you what your questions are, or what you feel are particular issues that you'd like to have dealt with here, because I want to make it as relevant and particular as we can. Do any of you come with particular questions or problems you want to explore?
Mm-hmm. Peggy? I think you call it breath control, how you read as you're reading a long text, for instance.
Uh-huh.
Without gasping in the middle of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's really, when you're reading the Bible, it's a real killer sometimes, isn't it?
Even if you've practiced sometimes.
Even when you've practiced, yeah. Yeah, I will just, since I don't have that listed, this isn't one of the things I plan to cover, I'll just talk about that now. Basically, it's a matter of relaxation. Simply relaxing and breathing normally. Hi, Mary. Then phrasing the way you would phrase if you were just simply speaking. And I think that's probably the key idea that I want to get across to you, that when you're reading aloud to a group of people, yes, you are reading aloud to a group of people, but your task as reader is to make it as natural as possible. And not a lot of people do run on sentences like they have in the Bible. I mean, usually we talk in shorter sentences. But if we do a run-on sentence the way they have, then we have found, then we find places during that sentence where we pause and breathe. So let me see if I can make up something. About the middle of the morning, I took a walk over to 10 Mile Creek, and I passed all sorts of trees and plants. I went up the path and down the path over roots of trees. That could be two sentences. It's hard to do. It's hard to do what they do. But I mean, it's unspeakable. But what you do often have one where you have the sentence starts at the top of the page, and about 10 lines down, you've come to the end of the sentence, and God knows what's in between, you know. But you have to, as reader, get that, connected to that, for the people who are listening. And so what you do is you just know that it's okay to stop and breathe. And you'll just find those places as you're preparing. I hope that you have one in the reading that you do today. I hope someone will have one so we can work with it and see. Because it's okay to stop. It's okay to pause when you have that sort of thing and gather your breath and go on. That's right, yeah. The thing about planning it ahead is that you know that there's one there, which helps you to relax so that you don't have to tense yourself, brace yourself for it, and try to get through to the end. Like that. Good. Luidi?
As a singer, I have learned from the beginning to always take a breath at the same place when I'm practicing a piece, so that my body automatically knows to do it, and it begins to learn to gauge how much air it needs to let out up to that point. And I just put a little comma above the place where I'm going to breathe, and I sometimes do it when I'm going to read.
So Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Put a splash mark.
Mm-hmm.
There's some that's worse than the big names that you write.
The breathing.
Is that a punctuation sometimes. I found even after practicing, you know, after practicing at home, and you get to church on Sunday morning, and suddenly you're reading, and you're thinking, wait a minute, now I don't understand what I'm saying here.
So
on the lessons are the passages where things are put in parentheses, and you know, that they, I find that if I do my own punctuating, that it reminds me of what I am saying.
Good. Yeah, I used to recommend to people to take to the service the sheet that they've practiced on in order to avoid surprises for the eye. I no longer agree with that because I've realized that for me it's important, you know, that the book that we have in common is an important element in the worship service. Its symbolism for us as a people worshiping together is very, very powerful. I really loathe these little sheets of paper that have the text printed on that people read from individually, you know, so that the strong inner dynamic of eye, mind, engagement is turned on at the same time that we're having the corporate worship experience of having the words come in our ears and minds together as a congregation. I really find those little sheets very offensive. I think it's wonderful if they're passed out as people are leaving to take home to reflect on lessons or to go back and look at something, but I think it's destructive to corporate worship. And so what I like to see happen in churches is, first of all, there'd be a big print Bible there to read from, but then that the church office sends out to the readers in advance a Xeroxed copy of the text they will have in the service. And that you can have that, you can bring that in your purse to church and still look at it before you go up if you want to. But you leave that at the pew. And when you go up, you read from this very important volume which we're all gathered around. Because the symbolism of that is very important and the corporate experience of it is very important. So I think those kinds of marks and stuff that on that page are helpful in preparation. Mm-hmm. Then when you're reading it from the same page, you do it. Yeah.
It's easier to read than
the sheet anyway. Yeah. And the thing is, too, that when you're reading, actually, in the worship experience, your mind isn't taking in those symbols. Your mind is really needs to be committed to the text. And having done the preparation, those other things fall into place naturally. Yeah, Ray.
One of the things that I'm constantly reminded about as a voice teacher is that you can work out those breath markings very, very carefully ahead of time. But in performance, panic causes shortage of breath.
Yeah.
So the practicing of breathing is even more important. If you're at all tending to be at least a little bit nervous, you won't make it to your breath marks if you've made those too far apart.
Mm-hmm.
So give yourself plenty of places where you can breathe if you need to, or you don't have to. But don't feel that you've committed a terrible crime by putting a pause in there. I think we've gotten so used to listening to radio and TV and this constant sound.
Barrage of sound,
When you're reading it, especially if, as you say, if we're not following along in those printed texts, which, by the way, are necessary because most reading is done so terribly that that's the only way you can follow.
Yeah, but that's
that if you do put a little pause in there, you're giving people's minds a chance to catch up with you. Most people who read or acting plays, well, you know, this tend to go way too fast because they're frightened mm-hmm. of a half a second silence.
Yes.
And we as Lutherans probably are more afraid of silence during the worship service than of anything else in the world. Silence is frightening, but silence is fine. Even if when you get up there to read, take a few seconds to collect your thoughts.
Yes.
Say a silent prayer. And that's fine. You don't have to launch right into it.
Yes. I think that's just a terribly important point that... And I think we should probably talk about that, spend a little time talking about that, because the problem of relaxation is enormous. And it has to do with the sense of being up in front of people, of all eyes being on you, of the possible judgments out there about either the way you look or how you're doing what you're doing, will I be good enough, and just being involved in that situation can be terribly stressful in and of itself, so you don't have time to deal with the text that you've come to read. And so...
that's why commitment to the text means so much. It's so helpful, because if you're truly committed to getting this word to people,
mm-hmm.
And that they understand what's being said here,
mm-hmm.
then you get your mind off yourself and you can...
Yeah, that's right. And you've done your homework, and you've done all of the preparation, and so, and it is a privilege to be able to read and to participate, to offer this, to make this as your offering in the service, and to have the opportunity to make meanings for people, and meanings about something which is so important to us as worshiping people. And so when we bring ourselves to this, if we're asked to read and we bring ourselves to this task, then it's helpful not to see ourselves as the person who is giving the lessons, but to see ourselves as the one through whom the lessons will be presented. And the sense of it being, of your being an organ, simply an instrument through whom this will happen for other people by the grace of God is, I think, very liberating. I used to always begin the service where I'm reading, always begin with a period of prayer about this, that I will get out, that I will be out of the way, that what I do will be free to allow God to speak to the individuals, the people, through what I do, but that it will be informed, you know, from Him, not from me. And I found that so important that now I do it with all of my work. I've become aware that it isn't only when I'm reading lessons. Certainly there it was very, very clear to me, but it's become clear that all of the work that I do, whether the play I'm doing is a secular play or not, it's still what I have to put out. And so it's been a very meaningful journey for me in that respect. And that active prayer is a liberating thing, because from that point then, you're off the hook, basically. You know, you've done the preparation. You've kept faith with the task and committed yourself to the text, and so you don't have to worry about what it is you're going to do or where you're. I don't mean to be disagreeing with you, because I think the breathing is terribly important, and having worked all that is terribly important. But you don't have to worry about it. All of those things. You don't have to worry about the concentration, because you've created the images that go with the words that you're reading, the pictures that you're conveying, the sense of what you're doing. You have clear personal images for each of them. You don't have to do it on the spot while you're reading. It's been done, so your brain holds it for you. The emotions that, or the feeling in the text, you don't have to worry about generating anything on the spot to communicate the meaning, because, Mary Jane, if you want to move to see this piece, because you've you've internalized all of that. It's there, and it will be called from you as needed, so you don't have to push anything. What to do with the people say, well, you know, what do I do with my eyes? Where do I look? Do I look at people? Do I not look at people? Do I look short? Do I look in the book only? Or, you know, all this sort of thing. You don't worry about that. The eyes are liberated. Facial expressions are liberated. Gestures, you know, no canned gestures that come out. We have a dear man at the cathedral in Seattle, and he memorizes his texts, and he plots hand gestures. And I keep hoping someday he'll ask me to give him feedback, because I want to tell him, you know, just keep your hands down, please. You know, just keep your hands down. Don't worry about them, because if a gesture comes, it'll come, and you don't have to make it. And appropriate voices. Often in the texts we read, there are different people speaking. God speaks, the people speak, Moses speaks, you know. You know that they're different voices, and automatically you will communicate, in communicating the meaning, you will communicate the different people without laying on a voice. And so all of these things get liberated by commitment to the text, doing your homework first, and giving it time. This is the other thing. Pastors used to be in a bad habit. I think they're getting much better, and the indication here proves that, about giving people forewarning so that they have time. And when you're reading, you should begin preparing, you know, several days in advance. Read it on Monday and spook out any of the problems, pronunciations, references to things you don't know, reading what came before in the text and what follows after, getting familiar with the other lessons. If you do that on Monday and try to come back to the text several times during the week just to read it, spend some time with the images in it. You know, Jesus went to the lake and climbed into a boat. Well, that's a fairly simple image. But give yourself the image of Christ's figure moving down to the lake, stepping into the boat. And when you do that, that's there forever. Your mind has that image, and every time you read it, then what you do will be imbued with that image, and it will be strong, and it will be more clear to the people who are listening, because you have that picture in your mind. You don't have to generate it in detail when you're reading it, because it's there, you have access to it. Okay, are there any others? There was some, yes, Ray, go ahead.
I don't know if anybody's guilty of this anymore, but have you ever read the book, How to Become Bishop Without Being Religious?
Ooh, no.
A delightful book, but one of the things, requirements for any pastor who wants to become bishop, cultivate the stained glass voice. Yeah. And if I could only play you a tape recording of a former pastor, you would know the quivering,
the old style.
And it was really difficult for some people not to try to imitate. I mean, after all, this was the voice, the great
God
pipeline from heaven.
Oh, just, dear.
If anybody's inclined.
Stained glass voice.
Maybe we don't have to use those kinds of things.
Some things we can be spared, huh?
I know. A lot of times I worry about the pitch of my voice, because I know when I get nervous, it goes up.
Right.
And I also, when I get nervous, I tend to, the volume really drops off.
Uh-huh.
My voice.
Uh-huh.
And so, and if I'm real nervous, I can even, I mean, I've had situations, not reading in church, but other situations where I was very nervous, like in job interviews or that kind of stuff, when my voice completely changed.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was not my voice at all.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't able to do anything about it. You know, and I knew, this is not good. You know, so those are some things that I might work on.
Uh-huh.
I also in my work, sometimes I have to get up in front of large numbers of people.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not necessarily going to read something, but, you know, just speaking. So,
mm-hmm.
Some tips around that.
Yeah.
That's exactly my furniture.
Is that right? Sort of clutching up and...
High-pitched voice, and by the time you get both of them together, it's awful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that being, first of all, catching yourself, being aware of when you're doing it is, of course, the beginning to dealing with, is the first step in dealing with it. And when you find that happening, if you will just stop yourself for a moment and take a deep breath and know that it's okay, people will wait. And it's all right to ask them to wait by making them wait for the next thing, simply because you have a job to do and you have something to communicate, and that you can't make the gift of who you are and what it is that you have to offer these people unless you're in a position to do it. And so you don't want to get in the way of it. So simply put it down for a moment. Take a deep breath and just, I don't know, it's easier for some people than others, but it's simply a matter of practice to take a check on yourself and then just simply drop the relaxation through so that you just train yourself. And that's something that you can teach yourself to do, whether you're driving a car, if you're walking down the road, if you're, you know, working anywhere, just take a check, be aware of the tension that you may have gathered, and just say, release it, let it go. And then your voice will probably take care of itself. In terms of the volume, that's a matter of opening your mouth, I think, isn't it, Luigi? I mean, you have to have breath to project anything. Well, if you've studied singing, I assume you know. And if you teach speech, you probably know better than I. But it's a matter of, you know, letting the air move through you, but then opening your mouth so that you can be heard. And it helps sometimes to think about projecting to the back. I mean, you can hear me better if I'm thinking about reaching the far corner of the room, even than if I'm thinking about reaching this circle of people here. You can still hear me. But you could hear me better a moment ago when I thought about projecting a little bit past you. And so... relax, open the mouth, and put it out there. Don't apologize for it. A lot of readers do, you know, they get up there and they feel self-conscious. And then they bring it down as an apology. Like, excuse me for standing here and reading this to you, but I'm going to do this and then I'm going to be done and everything will be, and then I can start living again.
You know. The same is true of emotion.
Oh, the thing about emotion, yeah. I was talking with Helen about this the other day, about in terms of singing, because it's one of the things that's always terrified me about singing, because if I sing something which moves me, I cry very easily, and of course that's disastrous, and as well as embarrassing and all that. So I've never really explored singing as much as I would deeply like to. And the thing is, you don't want to do that, because then you get in the way. You rob the audience of the meaning, because then right away they're worried about you falling apart in front of their eyes. And so when you're reading the lessons, that preparation is time to adjust. It's like, you know, if it's a grieving process, it's a grieving process or whatever. But you get to the point where you can refer to those things and it will have meaning for you and your listeners, but you don't get hung up in it. Which is why theater appeals to me, because we have a rehearsal process where I have to, in a disciplined way, come to terms with that. For me, part of the rehearsal process, and it comes fairly soon because of my low threshold, but different places for different people. I will simply play a rehearsal where I simply go for all of the feelings in it and take the feelings really to an extreme, so that it will be, I get them out. And then from that point, then I know, okay, for some reason I feel like they have to be acknowledged. Now I've acknowledged them. I can get to the business of really playing the scene, because the scene is about an action which I have. You know, I need something from this person. I'm going to get this person, and while get this from that person. And if I am, you know, crushed inside about something while I'm speaking to the person, it'll have to take care of itself, because my action is to get that. And so I can't get hung up crying or worrying about the pain. I've got to convert that into the action of getting that from, you know, whatever it is that I need. And so it becomes forceful and powerful, and it's imbued with the anguish and the grief perhaps that's under it. But it's not what I'm playing. It's not what the scene is about, you see. So I'm safe. I've dealt with that. And then by the time we're in performance, then it's okay. You know, I can be real, you know, I can be powerfully on the mark and authoritative about something, which is, for the viewer who knows about the grief and who knows there'll be a larger picture, it becomes something rich for them. Okay, I'm just going to quickly, if there's anything else, I'll just quickly go over the list here before you, and I wrote them down so that you could copy it if you like, because I didn't want to make a bunch of copies. But first question, what's going on in the text? You have to know who is speaking and why they are speaking. You know, the people, the voice of God comes through the mountain because the people have made the calf, okay? So you know that. That's the sort of thing I'm talking about. Who is being spoken to? Is it an individual? Is it a conversation between two or three people informally? Or is it something Moses from the mount to the people? Is it God spiking, you know, spooking a prophet in the back of the cave? You know, what is it? So who is being spoken to? Where is this taking place? What's happened just before the text begins, or the story, or whatever you're reading? What is the intention of the text? And for this you need to know what the other lessons are, the kind of theme for the day, and so on often, as well as the context of the text. But what does it want to do? Because that's going to influence the way you do what you do. What are its distinctive characteristics? By that I mean, is it narrative? Is it didactic? Is there a debate going on? Is it a listing of things? Does it set up a certain situation and then do a sudden reversal and come back the other way? You know, people, these people say this and those people say this, but I say unto you. You see, so that you have that kind of sudden reversal. Are there repetitions? Are there repetitions of phrases that come up, and how do you deal with them? Or is there a word that keeps coming up? How do you deal with that? If you have a word that is repeated a lot of times, is that a word that gets emphasis? Or is it perhaps the word next to it that gets the emphasis because it's already emphasized by the fact that it's repeated? You see, these kinds of choices are things which you as reader can make. Are there contrasts? What are the contrasts? Big issue. And modifiers for words. Those are often, you know, subtle, and if we, there was a large this, there was a large that, there was a large this, there was a very large such and such. You know, the word very is important. There was a very large such and such, because that's what makes it different from the other larges. So, how does the text feel? Is it stern? Is it comforting? Is it joyous, or is it arousing? How does it feel? What do all the words mean? How are all the words pronounced? And if it's a Bible text, we have to deal with them. Okay. Just a word or two about natural speech patterns, because of that's what our goal is to use as much of our range as we can, which is why the thing of getting locked into a high voice is a problem. When we speak normally, we use a whole lot of levels, and we want to make use of them. Oh, I know what Ray said earlier. I was trying to think what that was. The difference between what's written on the page and what you say when you read it is the difference between reading for the mind and reading for the ear. The commas, for instance, one of the biggest example is the use of commas. The Bible is so chock full of commas, it blows your mind, especially in some translations. And some people feel that they have to honor every comma that comes along, and it becomes monotonous, and in fact blurs the meaning. But when we are speaking, you have inflections, you have time variations, you have, as well as for people who see, you have visual communication, and so you don't necessarily have to give each comma a pause. You have the changes in rates to create meanings. We group our sentences so that sometimes it goes along evenly, but most often it doesn't. Most often we, you know, stop and start and begin again all over within the same sentence. And that's part of the natural communication. In natural speech patterns, questions in America are usually with an up inflection. If I were to ask a question with a down inflection, is there another speech pattern or country that comes to mind? Did you all have lunch today?
Ukraine.
Pardon?
British.
Yeah. But in America, it's usually an up inflection. Sometimes you hear, especially young people these days, will often speak with, Catherine speaks always with an up inflection. Have you noticed her speech? Now, if you've all finished lunch, I will give some announcements. You know, she has always an up inflection, and a lot of young people do especially. Generally speaking, the rule is that if there's a question, there's an up inflection. If you have a list of things, you should keep either an up inflection or an even offering of it until you get to the last and final one. And then you take it down, because coming a downward inflection finalizes, creates a conclusion. That's what those little lines mean, blip, 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 down, or else blip, 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 down. Yes, and coming down an inflection to a period is the end of an idea. If you read up and down like this and go up and down so that you're creating variety in your speech and it's up and down like this, it's sort of, think of a serpent, it creates doubt in the mind. And if you're reading about the serpent talking to Eve, it's a wonderful device to use, you know, if you want to convey that. But you may not want to use that injudiciously, because if you have somebody making a direct, firm statement, but you read it with a serpentine inflection, it's going to detract from the impact, the importance of what's being said. No variation is monotony. If you're reading something where someone is named as being, you know, where attention, someone says listen, or someone says Lord, blah, 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 or hey, blah, 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 whatever. If you pause after the name or after the imperative to listen or whatever, then you gather attention to what's being said next. So it's a technical little device, and you should use it when you read, because the people who are listening are helped by that, you know, split second of silence is helpful, because it brings them there, oh yes, you know. A is usually pronounced ah, V is usually pronounced the in readings. And then the two very, very important ones. Number 9, any word that can be omitted without changing the meaning should never be emphasized. because it's not the new idea. Always, the last one, you always want to, you're always setting up the new idea. So when you're reading, look at what comes next and see what's new about this, what changes, what change, everything that you say changes, you know, what's been said, grows from what's been said before. And so that's always the question as reader, what's the new idea here? Okay. Then I started to put notes about presentation, but it's 20 of 3, and I'm afraid we're not going to have any time for feedback if I go into that. We could do another session sometime on presenting the lessons. This is preparing the lessons. And I think that everything else will come out as we work with text. So are there any questions before we begin just taking examples and working? Okay, good. Who would like to take a turn first? Someone's brought something that they'd like to share with us and get feedback on? Good, Peggy. Great.
I think the idea is so interesting, that's why I'm volunteering.
Oh, good, okay.
I think that's very helpful.
Good, I hope so. Yeah, I think it's helpful not only for the people who do it, but also for people. I appreciate your generosity.
This is not from the Bible. And I would like to say that the small girl in this had just turned 4. A small girl wonders, in the hot, dusty August, the milk soured quickly, and the flies buzzed around, heedless of the spirals of sticky flypaper which hung from the ceiling. My brother Robert scooted around on the floor, not quite ready to walk. I like to get down on the floor and play peekaboo with him to make him laugh. One day he was feverish and listless and refused to play. The doctor came at noon and took medicine for Robert out of his little black bag. He diagnosed the illness as cholera infantum, a dread disease which took the lives of many infants in households with no refrigeration. "Isn't there something, anything we can do?" my parents pleaded to the doctor as Robert grew worse. And so Dr. Bigelow asked the specialist to make the long trip from Waterloo. This specialist, Dr. Waterbury, gently told my parents that it was too late for him to help. Robert lay uncomplaining, obediently swallowing the useless doses of medicine. I remember that Harry and I were playing boisterously under the young elm tree when someone asked us to play more quietly out of respect for our brother who had just died.
Thank you very much. Excuse me, but I'm concerned just to take...
Too much time.
No, please don't.
Oh.
Thank you very much. I would like to just work with what you have
good.
So far, okay? Because, there's everyone wants to see what the adjustments, okay?
Yeah, if I can. I'm smart enough to catch on.
Okay, good. Yeah, great. Fine, thank you. First of all, where is this taking place?
I realized when I read this that it wasn't. Obviously, it was in our home. Okay. That should be in there, shouldn't it?
Was it? Well, I'm not critiquing the writing at all, okay? But I'd like you to begin reading it again, and you can slow it down. Take the time to picture what it is that you're saying, okay? And you're writing this in the first person,
mm-hmm.
and so the relationship to the people that are in it is, how old are you in relationship to the brother?
Well, he was 13 months old. He was not quite ready to walk.
Yeah.
But it says,
and how old were you?
4.
And you were 4.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you think for a minute about, can you just close your eyes and put yourself back there for a minute? And now, would you please start reading it again? But you are the speaker, and you are telling us this story because you want to share with us
something that was important in my life.
Something important mm-hmm. in your life, and all of it, and that it's an event that has a lot of feelings around it. Is it an event in which you learn something?
Eventually.
Eventually. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the idea, if that's what you're going to get to in telling us the story, I want you to give it the kind of importance and respect that you gave it by writing it.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, because that's the whole point of it. That's the whole point, is to communicate what it is that you've written. And so we want to hear. Okay, it sounds like something that would be very moving. So take us with you on that journey.
Are you saying be a little more emotional? Would that be?
No, I don't want you to be more emotional. I want you to be really clear about what it is that you want from us. You want us to understand something important that happened to you. And in order to do that, you're going to have to take us with, my feeling right now is that you are laying the story on us. You're doing it very, very quickly. Your tempo is consistent throughout, and it is a similar pattern that you're using for all of the various meanings that you're in. But I want you to set up the picture clearly for us. You want to bring us there. And so set up the picture clearly for us. Let us know how it was. And you can take all the time you want.
That's very helpful. That's why I came to this class. In the hot, dusty August, the milk soured quickly, and the flies buzzed around, heedless of the spirals of sticky flypaper which hung from the ceiling. My brother Robert scooted around on the floor, not quite ready to walk.
Just go back to the reference to your brother Robert.
Okay.
He's a new idea to us, and so we want to get him clearly in our minds.
To leave a little space between the sentences, are you saying?
That would be a good idea there. I would consider that.
My brother Robert scooted around on the floor, not quite ready to walk. I like to get down on the floor and play peekaboo with him to make him laugh. One day he was feverish and listless and refused to play. The doctor came at noon and took medicine for Robert out of his little black bag. He diagnosed the illness as cholera infantum, a dread disease which took the lives of many infants in households with no refrigeration. "Isn't there something, anything we can do?" my parents pleaded to the doctor as Robert grew worse. And so Dr. Bigelow asked the specialist to make the long trip from Waterloo. This specialist, Dr. Waterbury, gently told my parents that it was too late for him to help. Robert lay uncomplaining, obediently swallowing the useless doses of medicine. I remember that Harry and I were playing boisterously under the young elm tree when someone asked us to play more quietly out of respect for our brother who had just died.
Thank you.
Was that better?
How did you feel about it, Peggy?
Puzzled. The title is A Small Girl Wonders, and some of the puzzle comes out later. But it was, I remember it distinctly.
Yeah, but I mean, how did you feel about the shifts that you just made?
Oh, about that. Oh. I think maybe I followed a little bit of what you said. I hope.
Anybody here think she did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was much better.
That's really helpful.
Sure, the first time she read, my husband and I are traveling by car, and so I'll read articles in magazines to him. And that's just more, just reading it and getting it over with. That's the way she was reading the first time, rather than getting us to participate in the story when you take the time. And if I were reading a book to him or something, you know, as we're driving along, you take that time and make it so that they can see the picture of what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's what I think we needed to do, is get that.
Every time you gotta jump, like when you jump from the fly paper up on the ceiling, you gotta take time there. Mine jumped on the
floor
when
we were
playing with them. And then we had to jump from there to the tree or to the doctor coming all of a sudden. That space in there would have given me a little more time to see the doctor come in the door and open up his little black bag.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, really helpful.
And then jumping the months, the space could have been used again. Mm-hmm. To jump, not months or days, but from that time to the time when you were playing boisterous later. The different scenes, kind of, that you projected. You've got a beautiful job of describing the scenes, I think, in your writing.
Yes, I missed them the first time. I missed them. I didn't get mental pictures the first time at all. The second time, I really went with you, and you set up. When you started again about your brother on the floor, I saw him after you made the adjustment. Yeah. And then it shifts from describing the heat of the day and the place to your brother, and then I as the new idea. And days for that, those new ideas are the things that.
That's very helpful.
Clearer the second time. You did well with making adjustments. And you can continue to just keep working in that way. Mm-hmm. Take your time. Also, another thing that happened was that your voice became. You used much more of your voice and the inflections, the range of inflections that you had the second time you read it, just automatically. I mean, I don't think that you were thinking about that.
No.
You were thinking about reading. But your voice increased its range by 80% the second time.
That's very good.
Thank you. I'd like to give someone else a chance too, but thank you.
I appreciate that very much.
This is a piece from Beloved, which is a novel by Toni Morrison. And the scene is a religious gathering of black people in which Baby Suggs is going to preach. Baby Suggs is an old woman who has preached to these people for a long time, and they have a great deal of reverence for her. After situating herself on a huge flat-sided rock, Baby Suggs bowed her head and prayed silently. The company watched her from the trees. They knew that she was ready when she put her stick down. Then she shouted, "Let the children come!" And they ran from the trees toward her. "Let your mothers hear you laugh," she told them, and the woods rang. The adults looked on and could not help smiling. "Then let the grown men come," she shouted. They stepped out one by one from among the ringing trees. "Let your wives and your children see you dance," she told them, and ground life shuddered under their feet. Finally, she called the women to her. "Cry," she told them, "for the living and the dead. Just cry." And without covering their eyes, the women let loose. It started that way, laughing children, dancing men, crying women, and then it got mixed up. Women stopped crying and danced. Men sat down and cried. Children danced. Women laughed. Children cried until exhausted and riven. All and each lay about the clearing, damp and gasping for breath. In the silence that followed, Baby Suggs, holy, offered up to them her great big heart. She did not tell them to clean up their lives or go and sin no more. She did not tell them that they were blessed of the earth, its inheriting meek, or its glory-bound pure. She told them that the only grace they could have was the grace that they could imagine. That if they could not see it, they would not have it. Here, she said, in this place, we flesh, flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet in the grass, love it hard. Yonder, they do not love your flesh, they despise it. They don't love your eyes, they just as soon pick 'em out. No more do they love the skin on your back. Yonder they flay it. and O my people, they do not love your hands. Those they only use to tie, bind, chop off, and leave empty. Love your hands. Love them. Raise them up and kiss them. Touch others with them. Pat them together. Stroke them on your face. Because they don't love that either. You got to love it. You. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Good. Good. Well, Jan, how did you feel about that?
I felt pretty good about it. I felt nervous in reading it. Did I appear nervous?
When she first started, she did. And I thought, because your voice would come down. And, I mean, that's how I felt.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to, you know, take a deep breath for you.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
And as you moved along, you seemed to get more force. That's how I
thought.
Strength.
Yeah. Okay. So it would help to slow down in the beginning?
I thought so.
I think you can slow down.
How about throughout the whole thing?
Oh, I think, well, one of the things that you do already very nicely is to vary the slow and the speeding up. And I think that you can just relax with that more, a little bit. But, you created clear images for me. I think that let this relax.
Okay.
A little bit. Take time to breathe more deeply a little bit. Just to add to your relaxation and know that, you know, we will sit here and listen to this, you know. But I felt and I think that as you do that, that you'll begin to develop a lower, you know, a little bit lower part of your range.
Okay, yeah.
Right?
Did you notice when Ruth asked you how you felt and when you answered, your inflection was from about the level that you had been reading this way. But that upper part of the inflection hadn't been used during your reading. Your inflection had been down here.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you were using that full range, and oh, people, this the upper parts.
Okay.
But it was very effectively done. I certainly didn't feel that there was any lack of your involvement in that. I think you got me into it.
Yeah,
I think I've worried so much about my voice getting too high that I tend to go down here and keep it, you know,
don't
down there. Yeah.
Don't be afraid of that. That can be a problem. One of our people on the staff has a voice which tends to be in the upper speaking range, strangely enough. Normally our speaking voice is about two notes above the bottom of our vocal range. But
interesting.
This person's tends to be up there, and it almost bothers. I wish that person would cultivate a little bit more of a lower range. I think it would add to the richness of the sound. But don't be afraid. I think a lot of times women have maybe been told, you know, men don't like to listen to you, your voices are too high.
Exactly.
You've also been told that women should not be lectured, by the way, because your voices are too sensual.
Oh!
Let me read the Song of Solomon.
You haven't ever heard that? Well, good. Maybe we're getting someplace.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the feedback.
And thank you for the feedback.
Plain song by Gregorian chant.
Okay.
Song
okay. Good.
Well, that's supposed to be unsensual.
No.
But I would hate to be going through life listening only to Gregorian chant.
I have to tell you that it's 3:02, and I'm happy to stay until 3:15 with whoever can stay. And I'm happy to do that.
Actually, I enjoy reading them, but I'm kind of shy. Except when I read, I like it, but then looking at all this stuff, and I get, ugh.
Three-quarters of that you already know. I mean, and anything that you're probably applying most of it anyway, so don't be intimidated by that.
Okay. Basically, I didn't have anything that I came with, so I opened up the Bible, and we have Jeremiah, the entire chapter of 24, which concerns a vision that Jeremiah had of two baskets of figs. After Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, had taken into exile from Jerusalem Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, together with the princes of Judah, the craftsmen, and the smiths, and had brought them to Babylon, the Lord showed me this vision. Behold, two baskets of figs placed before the temple of the Lord. One basket had very good figs, like first ripe figs, but the other basket had very bad figs, so bad that they could not be eaten. And the Lord said to me, "What do you see, Jeremiah?" I said, "Figs. The good figs, very good, and the bad figs, very bad, so bad that they cannot be eaten." Then the word of the Lord came to me. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, like these good figs, so I will regard as good the exiles from Judah, whom I have sent away from this place to the land of the Chaldeans. I will set my eyes upon them for good, and I will bring them back to this land. I will build them up and not tear them down. I will plant them and not uproot them. I will give them a heart to know that I am the Lord, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God, for they shall return to me with their whole heart. But thus says the Lord, like the bad figs, which are so bad that they cannot be eaten, so will I treat Zedekiah, the king of Judah, his princes, the remnant of Jerusalem who remain in this land, and those who dwell in the land of Egypt. I will make them a horror to all the kingdoms of the earth, to be a reproach, a byword, a taunt, and a curse in all the places where I shall drive them. And I will send sword, famine, and pestilence upon them, until they shall be utterly destroyed from the land which I gave to them and their fathers.
Thank you. But how, Bill, how did you feel about that?
Well, I got nervous, but... It's all right.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with that. I did a little bit, but not as badly as he felt it. I think that's right. I'd like to just ask you just to shake out your shoulders. Just good. You read very well. And you have a very nice voice. But I think that you can be. Just relax with it a little bit more. And I'd like to hear you read a little of it again.
Where are your glasses? There they are. Oh, I'll never read that.
Let's see.
Let's
see. There was something I was confused at the very top of this.
It is Nebuchadrezzar. King of Babylon had taken into exile from Jerusalem Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Oh, there we go. This is it. When you have this kind of a long description of one person, mm-hmm. treat it as though it had dashes between the words, mm-hmm. so that the whole phrase becomes the name. Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. He took together that man, together with the princes of Judah, mm-hmm. Together with the princes of Judah, the craftsmen, the smiths, and had brought them to Babylon. Boy, this is really a good one.
The Lord, the idea that you're getting, all of that is simply set up for the words, the Lord showed me this vision. I mean, all that stuff beforehand about the names and everything is a setup to get to this point. Mm-hmm. And so that's the one, that's the point that you want to head toward. That whole sentence is heading toward that, because we've got...